it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Hi there, my name is Peter Cole. I am a professor of history. I work at Western Illinois University in Macomb, and I'm also a research associate at the Society Work and Development Institute at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa.
And great to have you back. This is actually your third appearance on the podcast. I encourage people, this will be linked in the show notes, but Mr. Cole has joined us in the past to talk about the global history and influence of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, also known as the Wobblies, which we'll be talking about in this episode as well, specifically about one individual, Ben Fletcher, and Local 8 IWW union that he was involved in. Also, we did a podcast on the kind of the multiracial class war politics of Bay Area longshoremen.
Yes, it was for a book I wrote called Dock Worker Power.
Yeah, we encourage people to check out both of those. Great histories. And really excited to actually dig into the history of Ben Fletcher, who's probably somebody that you've seen on posters and maybe a book or two, especially if you've ever been in the IWW or have read about the history of the IWW. But we're really excited. Mr. Cole's written a book that's dived really deeply into his life and the history of his organizing. And as you were saying before we started recording, the book that you wrote for PM Press, you've actually gone back and did a second edition, and now this is even bigger than the first edition, correct?
That's right. The original edition came out with Charles H. Kerr Press in 2006-07. Kerr is a small, mighty press from the start in the late 19th century, but PM Press is issuing this new edition, and it's sort of twice as long, a lot more information.
Awesome. Yeah, I actually recognized the branding on the cover when I saw that. Charles H. Kerr Press has some amazing books. Mm-hmm. We Will Return in the Whirlwind is probably one of the best books ever written on the history of the Black liberation struggle, mm-hmm. from civil rights to Black power. They have another great book called Dancing in the Streets about Wobblies and kind of the post-war period that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Also talks about the Situationists and some other different groups. But yeah, they have a fantastic catalog. They have a collection of Lucy Parsons writings. So they have some great stuff.
You know, Charles Kerr Press, I believe, was the first publisher in the United States to publish Karl Marx back in the early 1900s. And it was also the original publisher of Mother Jones's autobiography. And so it was an honor to have them publish my book 13, 14 years ago. And, well, PM Press is also an awesome press, and so I'm thrilled to sort of be working with them.
For sure. Well, just to get us started, talk about who was Benjamin Fletcher, broadly speaking, and why is he important? Why are we talking about him today?
Yeah, well, Ben Fletcher, he's named Benjamin Harrison Fletcher. He always went by Ben. I say that, you know, he's the most important Black labor leader you've never heard of. If you're interested in unions, if you're interested in radical unions, if you're interested in socialism, if you're interested in African-American history and racial capitalism, Ben Fletcher is actually a pivotal figure, even though he is wildly unknown. So he was born in 1890 in Philadelphia to parents who had moved there from Virginia and Maryland, African-American. And when he was 20 years old, about, he joined the Industrial Workers of the World, the Wobblies, as they were nicknamed. He also joined, for a while, the Socialist Party. And then in 1913, when he was 23 years old, he became a founding member of Local 8, which was the the branch of the industrial workers of the world that represented dock workers on the Philadelphia waterfront. And Fletcher became sort of the most well-known leader. He wasn't the only leader, but he was the most well-known leader in Local 8. He also became the most prominent African-American in the industrial workers of the world. And he was the only African-American who was arrested in 1917 when the federal government did this mass roundup of Wobblies leaders across the country. And then he was the only one of the Wobblies who was African-American who was sentenced to long prison time at Leavenworth in Kansas, where he served several years. Yeah. And the union he helped lead, Local 8, was probably the most racially integrated union in the early 20th century. And so for close to 10 years, the union he helped lead was the most powerful, longest, most durable union, arguably within the IWW, but also was probably the most racially integrated, mixed race, multi-ethnic union in the United States, bar none, in that early 20th century era. And so Fletcher was the leader of arguably the most powerful union within the IWW, but also the only union that for more than a year had a significant black membership, even though the IWW was committed to anti-racist politics. And so Fletcher is the single most important black Wobbly, period. When he went to prison in 1918, he was he was the second most important black political prisoner of that time, Marcus Garvey being the first, although Garvey actually went to prison later, but in that same era, right? And so if you've heard of Marcus Garvey, Fletcher sort of should be in your sort of knowledge. If you've heard of A. Philip Randolph, who was the most prominent black unionist in 20th century America and early in his career was a socialist, Fletcher was essentially right next to him. If you've heard of Harry Haywood as a sort of a prominent African-American communist in the 1920s and beyond, well, Fletcher was also sort of ranked right up there with him. There is essentially, he's on the short list of black unionists, but also on a short list of black left leaders. And despite all that, really very, very few people in nowadays have ever heard of the man, even historians.
So on the description for the Fletcher book, it says that he was involved in Local 8, the IWW's Maritime Transport Workers Industrial Union, unquestionably the most powerful interracial union of its era. You spoke to this, taking a principled stand against all forms of xenophobia and exclusion. Tell us more about Local 8. You know, how they got started, their politics. You know, the IWW's always been known for, you know, not excluding people, unlike the business unions of the time, but just kind of, you know, walk us through Local 8 and why it's important.
Of course. So the IWW was founded in 1905 in Chicago and spread around the world within 5 years to dozens of countries. And Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution says that essentially no worker will be denied membership based on color, creed, race, or nationality. At that time, as you noted, most unions in the United States and many unions in other countries were xenophobic, were often sexist, often excluded not only immigrants, but generally speaking, darker-skinned people. The IWW was created in no small part to reject that idea because the argument sort of is one of the most basic ones among socialists, which is that we're workers first, and these other identities, while not insignificant, are less important because really the primary fault line in a society, in a capitalist society, is between employers and employees. Famously, the preamble of the IWW, employers and employees share nothing in common, right? And so in other words, they were class conscious and committed to class struggle. Despite that commitment, rhetorically and ideologically, the truth of the matter is the IWW did not organize many African Americans, although it also did have Mexicans and Mexican Americans, Asian immigrants and Asian Americans, women, etc. Right? So Philadelphia at that time was the third biggest city in the country, and it maybe was the fifth biggest port in the country in terms of traffic. And thousands of men at that time, the industry was all male workforce. Dock workers had really horrible work lives. Basically there was a lot of people who could do the work. The work was quote unquote unskilled, although I would argue against that, but that was classified as such, you would get hired just by the job. So you go down to the river, go down to a pier, maybe get hired. Maybe there's 100 people getting hired, but maybe 300 people show up and the boss picks, right? And often picks people based on, if you're of the sort of the correct ethnic group, correct religious group. Maybe you're the friend of the boss. Maybe you go to the same church as the boss. Maybe you also have to offer a bribe or a kickback to the boss in exchange for getting picked, etc. As a result of really the sort of the large labor surpluses, the disproportionate power of employers, but also the sort of nature of America, especially in the early 20th century, which was a huge wave of immigration, but also a migration of rural blacks from the South into industrial cities in the North, the workforce was roughly one-third Irish and Irish-American, one-third African-American, and one-third European immigrants of various sorts. As a result, generally speaking, those workers didn't get along with each other, but also employers would play people off of each other, right? And so, okay, you know, the Poles aren't, you know, doing so well today or sort of complaining about the work. Let's just hire African-Americans. I don't like the Irish. Let's hire some Italians. Yeah. And so Local 8 was, because of its principled politics, you could say, it was willing to and able to organize workers, a diverse workforce that generally played in the favor of the bosses. The union, with the IWW was able to overcome that, right? Like, that was founded in 1913. There was a 2-week strike. And the aftermath of that strike, basically employers agreed to a series of demands, including raises, but also that they would negotiate with this union. I should note that the IWW at that time refused to sign contracts because they always wanted to have their most powerful tool at their command. And the most powerful tool of workers then and now is to not work, i.e. to strike. And so if you sign a contract, generally in America and many countries, labor contracts have no strike clauses. The Wobblies never wanted to give up that power, right? And so the Wobblies are able, this Local 8 is able to sort of basically be, organize a multi-ethnic, multiracial workforce, remain committed to other IWW ideals as well. Sometimes this is also called direct action because workers would basically enforce their demands through the potential threat of withholding of one's labor, right? And as a result of this, they were able to enact a number of gains. You could argue that in and of itself, multiracial equality is actually a major gain. But like in addition, they were able to sort of command higher wages, get safer workplaces with less abusive bosses, and perhaps also super important, eliminate something called the shape-up, which had been the previous hiring system, which I briefly described, where basically a bunch of people show up without a guarantee of a job, and then the boss plays recruits off of each other. Instead, phones already exist at this time, although they're not common. An employer who needed a certain number of workers at a certain pier at a certain day and time would call up the union hall and say, I need X number of workers at Pier 38 tomorrow to work to load coal, right? And then the Local 8 would say, all right, these are the guys we're sending out to sort of do that work. And in addition to that, the gangs, because generally this work was done as gang labor. No one loads and unloads a ship by themselves. It would often take 100 or more workers to work a ship, would be integrated as well. So the Local 8 eliminated the shape-up, which was a huge benefit to workers, and integrated not only their union, but also the work that they did. Employers had segregated gangs because that also played to their benefit, playing workers off each other. The union obliterated those tactics, right? I could talk further about this, but this gives you a flavor, right? From 1913 then until late 1922, Local 8 was the dominant union on the Philadelphia waterfront, despite the hatred of employers and the animosity of the local government and then later the federal government.
Well, let's talk about kind of the racial dynamics inside. What was that process like of integrating it?
It's complicated and I don't know everything. I wish I knew more. I wish I could get in my time machine and beam back right to this moment. But, you know, as I already mentioned that the union ideologically is committed to integration, it is very interesting and noteworthy that they instituted it quickly. It perhaps would have been easier for them not to do so. Right. Nevertheless, they chose to sort of enforce this. Now, they do believe in within the IWW generally and within Local 8, there is democratic control, and so that means workers elect their leaders. The union also made a very conscious effort to make sure that different ethnic groups had representation in leadership positions. So, for example, during their initial strike negotiation committee, according to documents, sort of newspaper reporting, the union essentially had one member of each prominent ethnic group on the negotiating committee, right? And so representation, right? Similarly, at union meetings, it was in the bylaws, presumably, although I've never seen the bylaws officially, right, that there would always be a black and a white elected officer running meetings, say like the monthly meetings, right? And in addition to that, although I don't know if it was required, it was clear based on who was serving in various elected capacities that many African Americans, but also many non-black members were in the elected ranks at the local level, right? And so in addition to integrating the work gangs, they also seemed to integrate the union structure, and also by accounts within the union, integrated their social spaces. So like when they would hold picnics, when they would hold events, right? Like there was never any toleration of segregation whatsoever, right? And a lot of this evidence comes from IWW newspapers. So like, are those newspapers slanted? Well, media is all has a sort of a slant. There's no such thing, I would say, as true objectivity. But in my opinion, it's very noteworthy that many, many different stories about Local 8 highlight the diversity and highlight how there's integration. The union could have chosen to ignore those aspects and just talk about, for instance, their power to command a raise, right? Many, many articles within the IWW's publication, they actually publish many newspapers around the country, frequently note the diversity and seem to boast about it, right? And it is true that Ben Fletcher and Local 8 were often highlighted as examples for other parts of the country that the union was open to workers of color.
You brought up something really interesting. You said it might have even been easier for them not to be integrated. Can you explain what that means?
Well, I mean, I am happy to sort of lay the primary blame for white supremacy on those who had wealth and who wanted to basically justify slavery, which was the origins of racism in America, really come with justifying an institution that, puts people into bondage, right? In other words, slavery preceded racism as an idea, right? But fast forward to the 20th century, well, you know, do workers also have prejudices? Of course, right? And so it's unfair to simply blame everything on the bosses. There is prejudice, there is sexism, there is racism, there is xenophobia within the working class, right? And so do you push on that issue if your goal is actually to form a union, or which is primarily about representing the economic interests of the members? Well, I would say even in the 21st century, there are unions that are diverse that don't necessarily highlight racial and ethnic issues, right? Even if they might have a diverse membership, because putting it too much in front might alienate some people. Yeah. And so, you know, again, I can't read the minds of people who are long dead, but it is noteworthy that this union very clearly tried. Is it because one of the leaders was Ben Fletcher? And there were other black leaders too, but Fletcher was among them. No doubt, right? And so Fletcher, no doubt, was a significant factor in ensuring that the union would be overtly anti-racist, not just sort of including black members.
You know, one of the interesting things is that it says in the book that there's pamphlets and stuff about race. You also mentioned the IWW newspaper. I'm really curious, you know, what are these pamphlets saying?
The organization of my book's a little unusual, so let me explain that first, and then I'll come around to the question because you'll understand the connect, right? So my book is, in a way, two parts. Part one is a lengthy introduction by me that's basically a biography of Ben Fletcher, as much knowledge as I've ever accrued about Fletcher with some guesswork. And it runs, say, 70 or 80 pages. It's the most in-depth extended essay on the life of Ben Fletcher ever, right? The first edition also had this introduction, although this one's actually has even more because I've learned more, right? The bulk of the book actually are a series of documents that I've collected over the last 25 years, with everything, almost everything I'd say, ever written by Ben Fletcher, whether it was a letter to somebody that I've been able to locate, or something that he published, say in a newspaper, or everything ever written about him, published that I ever could find, right? With me providing brief introductions to what is upwards of 125 documents, which a historian like myself would call an original or primary source, right? And so every reader can basically read Fletcher's words or read what people wrote about him at the time that he was alive, right? And so this is a sort of a hybrid book in that it explores Fletcher and the union that he was a part of, both through my sort of gaze, but also that every reader can do for themselves what historians do, right? Which is actually sift through documents from the era that you're interested in and sort of make decisions for yourself, although guided by me, right? Now, in addition to trying to collect everything that Fletcher ever created or was created about him, I also added, because it's relevant, three documents created in the late 19-teens and 20s by the IWW about racism and about that were appealed to black workers. And so in the early 20th century, the polite terms were colored with a capital C or Negro with a capital N. And so the IWW, for instance, published, you know, 2 to 4 page pamphlets. One's called Colored Workers of America, Why You Should Join the IWW. Another was called Justice for the Negro, How Can He Get It? And so those are included in an appendix for readers to see. Now, for those of us who know the IWW, they were long on action and short on theory. And so for people who enjoy thinking deeply about socialist theory or analyzing capitalism, the IWW isn't the place to look, right? They, of course, talked about all these things, but they generally, Wobblies, including Fletcher, didn't write long treatises on, you know, the labor surplus value, right? Like, that's just not where they were at, right? Big Bill Haywood famously said, right, I've never read Marx, but I've got the marks of capitalism all over me, right? And so, you know, these documents, which are, I think, really interesting, they're not impossible to find, but they're rare, right? Like, are appealing to the ordinary black person in America in 1920. And it's very interesting to read those because they sort of basically say racism is pervasive. Lynching is common. Wages are horrible, right? The IWW can help you. So most unions didn't appeal to black workers. The fact that the IWW was creating literature trying to attract black workers is also noteworthy. These documents weren't written by Fletcher necessarily. It's possible they were, but I have no evidence of that. But they speak to the larger issues that I'm interested in, and I think many of us are, which is how to organize a multiracial working class.
If you can comment on this, but I've always been really fascinated with the anti-Klan stuff that they created.
Yeah, so it is fascinating. I actually include in the book sort of the famous IWW poster that is an anti-Klan poster. In the late 19-teens and 1920s, the Ku Klux Klan became an incredibly large and powerful organization across the United States with several million members, men and women, not just in the South, but across the land. Indiana had a Klan governor. Oregon was largely controlled by Klan's politician in the 20s, et cetera, right? The Klan often was not only racist, but xenophobic, anti-Jewish, anti-Catholic, as well as anti-immigrant. The Wobblies squared off on more than one occasion with the Klan, and I've read about those matters, but it's not really a major part of, or even a minor part of the book, although the poster that I include, well, it's a great poster. I've tried to find out the origins of that poster and failed. I believe it was created in the early 1920s, but I'm not even sure where. But the periodic clashes in Maine, in other parts of New England, out west, that the IWW had with Klansmen, San Pedro, California, near Los Angeles, are important. And I'm afraid that I'm no expert.
Anything in terms of just kind of the national IWW, was it clear that Local 8 was kind of out in front in terms of race? Or was it that, you know, the entire organization was kind of on the same level? Or, you know, were there even splits within the organization?
So there were splits within the IWW, but not over race. Generally, the IWW was anti-racist. That said, there were not that many black people and many locals, with the exception of the Philadelphia waterfront and timber workers in Louisiana and Texas in 1912, 1913, thousands of timber workers were briefly in the IWW in something called the Brotherhood of Timber Workers that was overtly anti-racist in the sort of the heart of Jim Crow South. Those two locations and worker groups of workers were the most prominent examples of putting IWW politics into practice, right? But I do want to say that, you know, the IWW organized Asians in California in the agricultural industry, Japanese and Chinese, who were treated as horribly as African Americans, right? That the IWW organized Mexican and Mexican Americans in the Southwest when those groups were treated similarly to African Americans. And I also really want to highlight, as you know from previous conversations, that the IWW exported these ideas to other countries where they organized so that, for example, in New Zealand, where the Maori in the early 20th century were treated horribly by white New Zealanders, that the IWW had a column in its newspaper that was written in Maori, probably the first time a non-native publication had sought to organize among the indigenous population in New Zealand. That in South Africa, the IWW and organizations influenced by the IWW were the first white majority organizations that started to organize the black majority, right? And there are other examples in other countries where what we're thinking about in the U.S. context, similarly, the IWW or members of the IWW were taking these same principles and applying them to many other countries, right? Like, and so race and racism didn't originate exclusively in the United States. It was really sort of European powers that colonized the Western Hemisphere to justify slave-based plantation labor. But like, so too, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, it always envisioned itself as a global institution. That was also a contrast with the AFL, the American Federation of Labor. The AFL had no imagination to organize beyond the USA. It was a nationalist union federation. The IWW's name intentionally was a rejection that borders essentially divide workers. Right. And in the early 20th century, there were also other unions that embraced similar politics that were sort of, you might say, similar to the WABs, even if they were not members of the IWW. And so I like us to think about this book on Ben Fletcher is largely about the U.S., but it's not exclusively because these issues are not limited to the United States.
You know, in the description in the book, Wobblies on the Waterfront, it talks a lot about recent immigrants from Eastern Europe and Irish Americans. How did the IWW bring them in? What were the kind of the challenges in bringing these new immigrants into the union, both in terms of just integrating into a multiracial union, but also, I don't know, language differences. I'm sure religious differences, you know, was an issue maybe for some people. How did that work out? We've talked a lot about integration in terms of African-American workers, but let's talk about these recent European immigrants.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's worth also noting that actually many immigrants and many domestic migrants were actually, it's also a transition from a rural peasant life to an urban industrial life, right? And so a lot of the people moving from Poland or what became Poland to Philadelphia or Ireland isn't really so different than a black man moving from, say, Alabama up to Philadelphia, right? You have essentially agricultural rural peoples who are confronting the reality of a new industrial urban world, right? They did share much in common, in other words, right? Now, East European immigrants, of whom there were a lot of especially Polish and Lithuanians on the waterfront, like hundreds and hundreds, maybe over 1,000, so they don't know what white means. White in Poland or Lithuania means something. It means the color of your bed sheets, not the color of someone's skin as having any significance. So it's always important to remember that European immigrants, or for that matter, immigrants from Asia, et cetera, have to learn what race means in the U.S. context. And that's not doesn't happen immediately, right? Although actually America's so racist. In fact, immigrants often learned quickly, it's better to be white in America than black. Yeah. But my point is that Poles and Lithuanians and other immigrants didn't automatically sort of look at African Americans with any difference than they would look at people who are not African Americans, right? They're all just newcomers, right? And Irish and Irish Americans, although there is a long history of urban rivalries in neighborhoods in many American cities, Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, Boston, the list goes on, the truth is that there's also, that's oversimplifies the matter. There were and are progressive Irish Americans and Irish immigrants. And in fact, in that era, many Irish radicals were part of the IWW. And so in Philadelphia, there were Irish and Irish American Wobbly leaders. In other words, you didn't just have to listen to Fletcher. You could also listen to his counterparts who happened to be more like you, quote unquote. But also that there was important Irish radicals who joined the IWW. James Connolly, who was one of the leaders of the Easter Uprising in 1916, and in which he was executed by Britain for fighting for Irish independence, was a Wobbly. He actually lived in the United States for some years before going back to Ireland. And Connolly was a Wobbly. Jim Larkin, who was maybe the greatest trade unionist in Ireland in that era and organized Irish workers both in England as well as in Ireland, which was a colony, of course, of Britain at that time. Larkin also traveled to the U.S. and also was very much an ally of IWW, right? If I remember right, he spoke at Joe Hill's funeral in Chicago in 1915. And so there were plenty of Irish and Irish Americans who were on the same team, as you were, right? Who were on the left. And so for a number of different reasons, although I can't speak for the individual choices, right, that thousands of ordinary workers make, right? There's a bunch of different reasons that these different groups might be able to overcome. And of course, once they demonstrate the power that sort of unity has, that in and of itself feeds on itself, right? And so, okay, you know, in 1913, maybe I'm skeptical, but by 1915, by 1917, you know, I'm on the team, right? Like, and so I might have been a little hesitant, and maybe I've learned, and maybe I've started to work more with people who are different than me and hang out with people and respect people like Fletcher, who's a great speaker and funny. And so it's a process, right? Like, it no doubt wasn't immediate, and no doubt there was also some who never were fully on board, but nevertheless accepted it because Local 8 was also delivering economic gains for all the members.
let's turn the focus back to Fletcher and talk about his career as labor organizer in a Wobbly.
Yeah, so I'm happy to do so. Fletcher is a really fascinating figure, and as much as I know about him, I hope this doesn't sound arrogant, but I probably know more about him than anyone who's alive, right? Just because I've chosen to spend 20 years thinking about him and researching him. But, you know, so Fletcher was himself the IWW's best calling card to organize African Americans. Yeah. And so Fletcher traveled a lot. So although he was a native Philadelphian and although he was a member of Local 8 and regularly worked in the industry, and I should say that the IWW didn't allow its elected leaders to earn any more than anyone who worked in the field. And they also mandated essentially annual elections and would force people to return back to the workforce. And so no Wobbly leader was ever getting rich. Right. That was because it was a revolutionary organization as opposed to one that was simply trying to increase their piece of the pie. Nevertheless, Fletcher, because he's black, because he's a radical, because he's sort of a dynamic speaker by all accounts, as well as being really humorous, Fletcher is constantly traveling. Right. And so there's multiple reports over the course of many years of him traveling as far south as Norfolk, Virginia, Norfolk being historically and still an important port, the biggest port in Virginia, to Baltimore, which had a very similar ethnic and racial composition as Philadelphia, maybe New York. I'm sure he spent time there. But he also organized dock workers in Providence, Rhode Island, which had a large black dock worker population, many of whom were Afro-Portuguese from like the Azores and other islands that the Portuguese had taken as colonies, as well as up in Boston. Right. And so Fletcher is over the course of, say, 1913, 1912, up through his arrest and imprisonment in 1918, is regularly traveling up and down the coast, right, to organize dock workers and more also to organize black workers generally, right, to the IWW. And so Fletcher was, you know, the only conclusion we can take is that, like, clearly he was a good organizer because he was constantly being dispatched, right, to multiple different places. Now, I'll just tell you one good story, right, that I learned in the second edition, but wasn't in the first edition. So in early 1917, Europe's at war, but America has not yet declared war. That will happen in April of 1917, Fletcher's down in Norfolk. Norfolk's in Virginia. It's actually where his parents are from. I speculate that his parents were very likely born enslaved based on their ages, although I don't know that for sure. In other words, Fletcher was the children of slaves. As far as I know. So Fletcher's back in Norfolk. He's organizing among dock workers. There's actually plenty of radical sailors and dock workers in Norfolk by many accounts. But rumors have it, according to Fletcher, that some people at a meeting that Fletcher later talks about were asking him about interracial sex, which is this sort of bogeyman, right, that white people, especially southern white people, use, right? Black men want to have sex with white women, and how horrible that is, right? And so someone supposedly calls out from the crowd, right, well, what do you think about, you know, white women having sex with black men? And Fletcher made a comment to the effect of, well, no one around here is darker than me, right? Fletcher was a very dark-skinned black man. What he meant by that was that, in fact, for many centuries, white men had been having sex with black women, often rape, producing a multiracial offspring who, because of America's sort of narrow view of race, all people of color are automatically black, right? And so even though your father might be white, your mother's black, right? And so Fletcher basically throws it back on this crowd saying, well, guess what? You're asking me about interracial sex. Lots of white men have had sex with black women, right? The proof is in the color diversity of America's black population. Supposedly, rumor got to him that some people didn't like his answer or more generally his presence. And so he heard that he might get lynched. And so he boarded a ship that night and sailed to Boston. Right. And then in Boston, he ended up making that his home for a while, got a job at a soap factory and started to organize. And I learned this also after my first book, married a white woman in Boston. Right. Like, I know very little about her. She had a child. So Ben Fletcher was, her second husband and was a stepfather for a while. And, that's reported on, I learned, because the federal government was spying on Fletcher and sort of found him again in Boston, right, during the summer of 1917 after America declared war. And the federal government was busy investigating the Wobblies. And so basically a federal agent interviewed Fletcher on several occasions at his apartment and noted that he had a white wife and child. And so the irony is, of course, that down in Norfolk, he was being asked about interracial sex. Fletcher sort of dodged that, right, in a sort of clever way, but ended up presumably having plenty of interracial sex for a while in his new home of Boston. Yeah, anyway, I could go on, but that tells us a little about really the sort of the footloose nature of Fletcher as an organizer, and also how he was a speaker that was in much command, but also how he was across many borders, right? Because I can only imagine the amount of interracial marriage in that era was infinitesimal and in many states illegal, right? And so Fletcher was a radical on multiple levels.
So you mentioned that Fletcher, you know, traveled a lot. Was he seen as sort of a national icon, international? What kind of spotlight did he have on him outside of the local area?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one I thought more about in recent years and less about when I was first doing work on Fletcher and Local 8. I've become more sort of global in my thinking, as have many of us. So Fletcher was widely reported about in the IWW press that would have been read around the country, and, well, a lot of newspapers, English language, would have traveled to other places with sailors and other workers. For this edition, I was able to locate and get translated several documents written in Finnish, so from Finnish language newspapers that the IWW ran in both the United States and Canada, which had small but significant Finnish populations. And as you may know, Finns were disproportionately active on the left in the IWW, as well as in the Communist Party in both Canada and the US, right? Sometimes they were called the Red Finns. And so Fletcher actually spoke to numerous audiences that were organized by predominantly Finnish IWW branches, both in the Great Lakes region of the U.S., but also he traveled on at least one occasion into Ontario and in the late 1920s, which was sort of after his heyday. Did he travel elsewhere beyond the United States? I have no evidence of that. It's possible, but I don't know. I also found him in the 1930s being reported on in a German language newspaper published in New York City, which was actually the longest German language running newspaper in the United States. And thanks to friends, I was able to get those translated, and they're published in the book in English translation. And so was Fletcher known about among Wobblies in Europe or South Africa or Latin America? It's reasonable to conclude that, but I don't have evidence of that. But I do have plenty of evidence that Fletcher was a very well-known figure nationwide, and also that other Wobblies who traveled, for instance, Big Bill Haywood, who would jump bail and move to the Soviet Union, yeah, around 1920, where he lived until he died in 1927. Haywood talked about Fletcher plenty, and others did too. And so his reputation probably spread to a number of other places where the left had some reach, but he definitely was an prominent figure in North America.
So let's now turn towards 1918. We've talked a little bit about it, but Fletcher is put on trial along with lots of other IWW members. What happens? Why is he in such hot water?
So a lot of people have heard of the Red Scare, and they associate it with the federal government, the U.S. federal government's persecution of communists. And that's understandable because they were a major victim of federal persecution. And some people even divide it between a so-called first Red Scare after World War I and then a second Red Scare for many years after World War II. And that's a bit more accurate and nuanced. The truth of the matter is that the Red Scare, the first Red Scare, began during World War I, very shortly after the U.S. declared war in April of 1917. President Woodrow Wilson's administration, working with Congress, passed a law called the Espionage Act, and then subsequently another law called the Sedition Act that basically criminalized dissent. So the most well-known victim of these is Eugene Debs, the leader of the Socialist Party, who in 1918 criticized the war, saying that basically the working class is going to lose their lives on behalf of the rich. And he was thrown into federal prison for 10 years, although he served, I forget, 3 or 4 years before he was released, right? Thousands of Wobblies were also arrested and many hundreds imprisoned for the same quote-unquote crimes as Debs, criticizing the war. Now, in the case of the IWW, it's a bit more complicated and interesting, perhaps, because the IWW, like most organizations on the left, were anti-war. And I'm not saying this just in the U.S., but also the IWW, for example, in Australia, helped lead the anti-war movement in Australia, say 1915, 1916. But in the U.S., the IWW chose not to take an official stand. Why? Maybe because they were mindful that to take an overt stand against the war would put a big target on their back, and the federal government would then come to wreck it. Even though the IWW chose not to take a principled stand, prior to the U.S. declaration of war, the IWW had published many critiques of the war, which was a European war, despite the name World War I. And, you know, it was very clear where the IWW stood, as well as most members. But these laws, the Espionage and Sedition Act, were first used to target the IWW, which was the largest, most powerful, and most influential left-wing union in America and among the world. And so, essentially, shortly after the war began, with no evidence that the Wobblies were actually interfering with the war effort, the federal government started to survey the IWW, gather information about many of its leaders, and then in September of 17, arrested more than 100 members, raided dozens of offices, and basically issued subpoenas for a bunch of people, right, including Ben Fletcher, as well as five other Philadelphia Wobblies. Then there was a mass trial in Chicago, which was the headquarters of the IWW, a federal trial, in the spring and summer of 1918. It was actually at that time the longest trial in U.S. history. Fletcher was one of the defendants. And after 4 months of evidence, in which not a single piece of evidence actually directly spoke to Fletcher, but more generally because he was a member of the IWW, right? The jury came back in under an hour, all 100 or so people guilty on all five counts, so that everyone got 10 to 20 year prison sentences, $5,000 to $20,000 fines, and Fletcher was one of them, right? And so he ended up being thrown into Leavenworth along with many other people. Several of the famous quotes attributed to Fletcher originate in that trial, right? Reported actually widely in the press, but also in Big Bill Haywood's memoir. You know, Fletcher says at one point to Haywood, you know, this trial, you know, lacks any color. If it wasn't for me, there'd be no color at all, right? A reference to his blackness. At another point, when the sentences are being read, he said something to the effect of, the judges not using proper grammar, his sentences are far too long. Yeah, and these are sort of humorous quips, yeah, that are, like I said, widely reported and actually in multiple documents in my book. They sort of reference this quote because so Fletcher becomes famous actually for being, the Wobblies actually are famous for having a gallows humor, and Fletcher was very much in that sort of wave, if you will, right? Like, and so Fletcher was basically thrown into prison for violating the Espionage and Sedition Acts. These are widely seen nowadays as seeing violations of the First Amendment. These laws were repealed shortly after the war, and most figures who were imprisoned during the war were subsequently had their sentences commuted and then later pardoned. But nevertheless, this Red Scare was very much a sort of a huge wedge that weakened the IWW, and at a time when the IWW was probably at their height of power. So too, Fletcher was one of the leaders in the IWW, was one of the people who was sentenced to, 20 years in federal prison, although he ended up serving, well, about 2.5 years, but over a 4-year period, because he got out on bail once. Yeah. And so Fletcher and dozens of other Wobblies were in Leavenworth prison. And I should say that hundreds of Wobblies were also in various other state, local, and federal prisons in this time period. So the IWW was the primary target of the Red Scare that later was used against communists, anarchists, and other left-wing radicals.
What happened to Fletcher upon his release from prison?
Yeah, so after his he gets out on bail in 1920, for a few months, and he goes back in because his he has to. He gets out in 1922, right? Like, and he's still active in the IWW. He goes back to his home city of Philadelphia. It's actually not clear if he's still in this relationship with this woman, although she did move to Philadelphia with him during the beginning of the war. And she was receiving some payments from the IWW to support her and her child at Fletcher's encouragement, right? Like, so Fletcher returns to Philadelphia. He probably is working on the waterfront. He's still an IWW activist. However, Local 8 will be weakened by the arrests and imprisonment of its leaders, will actually persist and pull off a major strike in 1920 with over 9,000 workers, will strike again in late 1922. But the 1922 strike, which Fletcher was not a major part of, although he was around, essentially destroyed Local 8's power. So there were still Wobblies on the waterfront, but they didn't represent the majority of dock workers. And then through the 20s, basically, Fletcher tried to reorganize Philadelphia dock workers, continued to speak by he travels occasionally, including, I mentioned, in the late 20s, he goes on at least one speaking tour of the Great Lakes region. In 1931, I believe, he moves to New York City and lives for another 18 years, probably that entire time in Brooklyn in a neighborhood called Bed-Stuy, although at that time it's not predominantly black, although it's transitioning. And he will live in a neighborhood with several other old-time Local 8 members who had also been imprisoned, who are white. A man named E.F. Doree, who was actually a Swedish immigrant, and a man named Walter Neff, who was a German-Swiss immigrant, and their wives and their kids. Fletcher and his wife, Fletcher remarried a second woman who was black. And Fletcher also, though, in the early 30s, had a major stroke. And by all accounts, including his letters, he had a long series of major health problems. And so he's only in his early 40s. But really, he doesn't hold down, it seems like, a steady job. His wife very likely helped support him. He continues to be off and on an IWW organizer. One could not help to speculate in the mid-30s when there's a massive surge in unionism, including radical unionism. Would Fletcher have been sort of a part of that if physically he had been able? Very possibly. But he'll die in 1949 after many years of sort of poor health in Brooklyn. And it's actually his death is covered in the New York Times and a number of other newspapers, as well as in the IWW press. But he really hadn't been an important figure since the early 30s. But even into the early 30s, there's documentary evidence of him being a speaker and considered by those who were his witnesses an incredibly dynamic speaker. But the truth is that his heyday is like 1913 through his arrest, 1917, 18. Then he's around in the early 20s, and off and on in the 20s. But it's really when he was a young man in his 20s was that he was most effective and most influential as a union organizer.
What do you think some of the major lessons are of Fletcher and Local 8 that they leave us with today?
We could have a long conversation, and there are probably a lot of different opinions. So nowadays in 2020, there is a surge of interest in unionism, in socialism, in anarchism, in radicalism, as well as sort of people becoming more appreciative of the interconnections between capitalism as an economic system and white supremacy as a racial system. And so, well, many people, the most well-known probably Howard Zinn, have talked a lot about that people need a usable past, right? We need lessons and examples of what could be done so that we can imagine things. Now, if nothing's ever been successful, maybe it never can be. But what if something has been successful? Well, that means it can be again, right? And so in addition to the practical lessons, and I appreciate that you were actually asking some specific, very pragmatic questions, right? Because I think those are lessons that a reader can take away from the story of Ben Fletcher and the union he helped lead, right? But I also do think that, like, you know, it's amazing, yeah, that sort of Fletcher specifically is a forgotten figure, right? And so I say, like, who would I compare him to? Well, have you heard of Fred Hampton? Right. Fred Hampton was killed in the prime of his early adulthood for being a radical anti-capitalist black leader in Chicago's Black Panthers. As far as I'm concerned, Fletcher was at least as influential as Fred Hampton. Right. He was, Stokely Carmichael. Right. the list of sort of radical blacks that have been embraced by people for having influence, but also inspiration, I would put that Fletcher should be considered in that roster, right? And I also think that the tactics and the ideology that Fletcher embraced, he wasn't necessarily anti-elections, although he personally didn't seem to vote and he didn't seem to sort of put much stock. But he was mindful of and appreciative of socialists who were members of the Socialist Party who believed in evolutionary or democratic socialism, right? Fletcher was pragmatic, I think. But he was, he put his energy into union organizing. He believed that his power was most likely to achieve some great breakthroughs through workplace power with other workers, regardless of their ethnic, racial, or national identities. Yeah. And so for me, sort of the obvious takeaway is that Fletcher was the leader of the most impressive interracial union, for a generation, right? And that it was not only sort of benefited the workers in the short term, but it was also overtly and explicitly anti-capitalist. And that I think those are lessons that people in the 21st century are, many of us are sort of open to learning.
You know, I was reading a little bit about Fletcher, and there are several other black IWW figures. I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about them.
So there were other African-Americans. There were thousands of African-Americans in the IWW. More in Philadelphia than any other place, as well as in, like I said, Louisiana and Texas in the 1912-13 period before sort of repression destroyed that union. The truth of the matter is that there's no other African-American can possibly sort of compare in terms of their impact at the moment, right? But there were a number of other African-Americans who were in the IWW, right? Including in Philadelphia. I mean, when Fletcher was arrested, there were other African-American leaders, too, one was named Dan White, one was named Alonzo Richard, one was named Glenn Perrymore. None of these men ever really left behind a footprint the way Fletcher did, and none were as prominent as Fletcher. But, like, you know, I would say that really, when it comes down to it, there is no one like Ben Fletcher. I do want to give a highlight, however, to a man who wrote an essay that's published in my book. It was written by a member of the IWW named Robert Herden. And the essay is in the appendix. It's called The Negro Worker Falls Into Line. It was published in the late 1920s. So here we've got an African American who lived in Chicago in the 1920s. Chicago, remember, was the headquarters for most of its IWW's life and still today. And so this guy was a radical. He was actually highly educated. He was a scientist, and he later went on to a career in chemistry, right? But this guy, Robert Herden, was a part of this multiracial bohemian scene that often was nicknamed Hobohemia, right? Because they were hobos who were so working class people, sometimes who rubbed shoulders with middle and upper class people, but who were working class, self-educated often intellectuals, but also cultural radicals. And this group was famously nicknamed the Dill Pickle Club. And there were sort of places on both the near north side as well as on the south side where the Dill Pickle Club for decades actually had club meetings and basically hangouts, right? So this guy, Robert Herden, was a member of this scene in the late 1920s and early 1930s, right? And although he is very much not a household name, I don't think anyone really knows about this guy, right? The fact that you've got basically an African-American hanging out, right, with, I don't know, this dill pickle scene, right, that's more typically associated with sort of white hobos, is fascinating also to a partial door opening into a world that is sort of lost, right? And since also none of this is recorded in video or even on audio, we can only envision what this might look like. So I don't know if actually that's a great answer, because the truth of the matter is that that compared to Ben Fletcher, there was no one else. The only other person I'd like to give a shout out to is a man named Hubert Harrison. Hubert Harrison was a West Indian from the Caribbean, a black man, who lived in Harlem for many decades in the 19-teens and beyond. Harrison was a socialist, was a pan-Africanist, was for a while a Wobbly. He also for a while helped edit the newspaper called The Negro World, which was the official newspaper of Marcus Garvey's organization, the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And so Harrison was really a contemporary of Fletcher. Harrison's more of a intellectual. Fletcher was smart, but he didn't write long treatises on, well, anything. But Harrison did. Harrison was really a professional writer and editor. And so Harrison was part of this milieu, although I don't have evidence that they knew each other. I suspect they did. And then I guess I also should give a shout out to A. Philip Randolph and Chandler Owen, who were African Americans who ran a newspaper or a monthly magazine in the late teens and early 20s called The Messenger. They were socialists. They were huge fans of the IWW, and many stories appeared in The Messenger about Ben Fletcher and the Union Local 8. And so this world that Fletcher lived in the Northeast was, well, they all knew each other. And thanks to actually the federal government spying on Ben Fletcher's correspondence while he was in prison at Leavenworth, well, I have evidence that he corresponded with all these people, even if he didn't necessarily hang out with them in the same cities all the time. Yeah.
You know, one thing I've always been fascinated about looking at the history of early anarchism in the United States and also groups like the IWW is kind of the lingering question about why there wasn't more done and said against white supremacy and racism. And obviously, you know, the anarchist movement has, you know, some inroads into the IWW, but the two are separate, obviously. But, and do you feel that that's fair, or that there is just more history that we're waiting to uncover that kind of tells us a bigger story?
Well, I think that's an important question. And there's clearly a lot of overlap between anarchists and members of the IWW. In fact, some anarchists are IWW members, right? But not every Wobbly is an anarchist. Yeah. The way I see anarchism in that early 20th century, when anarchism was a very popular international ideology, and remember, this is before the Soviet Union exists, and so communism and Bolshevism exist as ideas, but actually are nowhere near. And so there were in many countries union movements that were anti-political or apolitical. They didn't believe that electoral politics was essentially a productive path to pursue socialism. And so the IWW is very much within this, underneath this umbrella of unions, anti-capitalist unions or revolutionary unions, as they like to call themselves, that were not opposed to the Socialist Party per se. They just didn't spend any of their time doing it. They just didn't see any gain to be made because they believed that essentially the ruling class controlled the political scene and the courts. And so what's the point, right? And so anarchism clearly shapes the IWW from its inception, right? It's one of the reasons I would say that it's more internationalist than it might have been. And I should say also that a friend of Fletcher's in Philadelphia, a man who went by the name Manuel Ray, who was arrested also and imprisoned in Leavenworth, was a Spanish anarchist sailor who then made his home Philadelphia in the mid-19-teens and then was deported after he was in Leavenworth for a while. Then he snuck back into America and actually living under an assumed name or a different name, lived for many more decades and became good friends with Sam Dolgoff, who was a legendary anarchist and Wobbly, who Fletcher got to know very well in the 30s and 40s when they were both living in New York City. There is a lot of overlap, in other words, between these groups. But Fletcher, I've never seen him identify as an anarchist, although in some of his thinking, he shares much in common, including a suspicion of the political system as a whole, instead prioritizing direct action on the job as the greatest source of worker power. As you know probably better than me, not all anarchists are interested in working class power or unionism. Some anarchists sometimes just sound like libertarians to me, right? The Wobblies, right, like were a working class union. And some anarchists very much embrace that, but not all anarchists, right? That's why there's clearly a connections, yet somewhat, I think it is important, like you said, to keep these matters separate. In my opinion, in the early 20th century, in the scene that Local 8 was a part of, the Philadelphia anarchist scene was small, but was principled, you know, anti-racist, anti-sexist, as was the case in many American places where anarchists were generally internationalist, generally anti-xenophobic, generally anti-racist. And my friend and sometimes co-author Kenyon Zimmer, who's written great books, including one called Immigrants Against the State, is really a history of anarchy in a few American cities in the early 20th century that explores some of these issues in more depth than I do.
Fascinating. Yeah, definitely we'll have to look at that book at some point. Anything else you'd like to say? I'm curious, you know, where does your eye kind of wander to next after this?
Well, so this book on Ben Fletcher, this new edition, it comes out with PM Press in December, although you can already order it. I'm really hoping, actually, to give talks in 2021, face-to-face less likely, virtually more likely. You know, like, I am... When PM Press sort of last year in 2019 sort of talked with me about creating a second edition of this book, I was sort of shocked because rarely do sort of books on subjects that I think are deeply important but nevertheless not widely shared, right? To have Second Life, I'd done so much more work on Fletcher, and because I had created the first edition of Ben Fletcher as well as Wild Beasts on the Waterfront, a lot of people found me, right, in the years post-publication. The opportunity, in other words, that I've had to sort of revisit this in order to make a much better book, because, like I said, I've over the years found much more up about him. Well, I'm thrilled to have that opportunity, right? Essentially to sort of, it's not perfect, but it's dramatically better than the first time I did it, right? Like, but for me generally, or in addition to continuing to keep the flame alive on this deeply important matter. Well, the IWW is, like many institutions in the 21st century, is actually more dynamic and has more members now than it's had since 50 or 60 years. So I'm very happy to see that more workers in many countries, I'm friends with Wobblies in Britain, in Ireland, in Germany, in Sweden, right? Like, I'm glad to see the IWW sort of rebounding, small still, but growing, right? And I believe this history could be useful to them. Me personally, I'd also like to give a shout out to another project I've worked a lot on over the last couple of years and will continue to for the future. It's called the Chicago Race Riot of 1919 Commemoration Project. And to be short, the largest episode of racial violence in Chicago history happened in 1919, in which 38 people were killed and over 500 injured. And the subsequent segregation of the city of Chicago was in no small part due to that episode. And so many people know Chicago is a segregated city. Few people know why, right? In other words, I'm often trying to popularize histories that are important, yet are long forgotten, quote unquote. Sometimes these are forgotten because those with power don't want us to remember this history, right? And so along with a group of people in Chicago, where I live part-time, we're trying to create a public art project in Chicago where we would place small markers at the location where each of the 38 people were killed in 1919, so that when people walking down the street of Chicago in 2021 will stumble across evidence and sort of a commemoration about this event that has shaped their place, they might learn something about the history of their city, but also they might understand a little better why the city looks the way it does literally today. And although we are primarily focused on public art, we also actually periodically give historic bike tours. I just gave one literally 8 days ago, right? Like to 50 riders. And it's predominantly on the south side of Chicago where a lot of this violence occurred. And so the Chicago Race Riot Project is another passion of mine and has been deeply meaningful since I live in Illinois for over 20 years now. And most of my students at my university are native Illinoisans, but they don't know that this history happened, right? Like, and so, you know, yeah, in the post-George Floyd era, right, where many more of us are thinking more deeply about the oppression of people of color, understanding and unearthing this history, well, I mean, obviously I've devoted my professional life to these subjects. Right. And so in the near future, I'll continue to work on the Chicago 1919 stuff, too.
Awesome. We thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. Encourage people to check out both Wobblies on the Waterfront and the second edition of the book on Ben Fletcher out on PM Press. It sounds like you can order it now and it'll be out in December. We'll have links, of course, in our show notes to both books and how to get them. Anything else you want to say?
Yes. So if you're still listening to this in October of 2020, actually there's a Kickstarter campaign going for the book. The book will be published regardless, but you have an opportunity now through PM Press to basically get different packages where you can buy the book, but you can also buy a t-shirt. You can also buy some other books that PM Press publishes and support basically this publisher, because the publishing industry is bleeding during COVID. And if you can buy directly from PM Press, you can sort of try to undermine the evil empire that is Amazon. And so even if it's after October 2020, you can still buy directly from this book from PM Press, where there will be you'll get the most bang for your buck, and you'll also help a small overtly left-wing institution that is doing a great job to publish these sorts of books, not just history, but also contemporary fiction, and but also things like cool T-shirts, right? Like, and so I encourage you to, if you're interested in my book, to do so at the PM Press website.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.